I would like to tell you about the only truly natural dog and cat food I have found anywhere. Most all companies add a synthetic vitamin mineral pack to their dry or kibble food. Nature's logic is different, with all natural ingredients and nothing man-made added. Their owner, Scott Freeman, worked for another pet food company, but decided he wanted to do things right. So he started Nature's Logic. You can check them out at natureslogic.com. You will find online and local stores where you can find their products. I spent a lot of time trying to find an all-natural pet food, and Nature's Logic was the only one out there. Give your pets the best and check out natureslogic.com. Your pets will be glad you did. They also have many other natural pet products to try.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for Wednesday night, the 23rd of March, year of our Lord, 2016. Our guest this evening is James Corbett. He should be joining us after the first break. Should be here in about 20 minutes. In the meantime, I will report on what happened in the markets today and then pontificate on a number of other subjects dealing with the economy. Start with the markets. Gold is down $28.20 today, and another adding insult to injury. In the overnight market, it's down another $2.60. So on the market right now, it's $12.18. Current price of gold, $12.18. It's been a bad day for gold, but it's bad for precious metals also. Silver is down 65 cents. That's 4.1%. Gold is down 2.25%. Silver is down 4.1% to $15.31 an ounce. Platinum's down 3.7%. $37 down to $9.62. Palladium is down 3.8%. That's $23 down for palladium. $585 for palladium. Bad day for precious metals. Dow Jones is down 80 points to 17,503. NASDAQ is down 53 points to 4,769. New York Stock Exchange is down 95 points to 10,100. Standard & Poor's 500 down 13 points to 2,037. Crude oil was down $1.50 during the day today and another 17 cents in the overnight market, and is currently priced $39.62 per barrel. The one, every one of the indicators that I'm looking at here that we routinely discuss, there are 13 indicators here at Kitco that I'm paying attention to. Every one of them is down except for the last one, and that's the U.S. dollar index. That was up about 41 points during the day, and it's up another 0.13 in the overnight market to 96.18. So today has been a happy dollar day, and it has been, slightly bad for the equities, and, bad. It's been a bad day for gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Just to put this in a little bit of perspective, so far this year, the price of gold has risen from $1,060 on January 1st to $1,220 today. If you had 100 ounces of gold at the beginning of the year, you would have made $16,000 on that 100 ounces. There are 83 days so far in the year. That works out to $193. You can just say $190 profit gain per day for the first 83 days of the year. If, in the likely event that we continued with that rate of return on 100 ounces of gold for the balance of the year, 365 days, you'd come to the end of the year $70,000 ahead of where you were on January 1st. Now, I don't expect gold to continue. What we're dealing with here is gold had a spectacular January and February, and then the last in March hasn't been that. And March has been flat or down for gold. So we can't expect that gold is going to continue to rise at an average rate comparable to what we've seen in the first 83 days of the year. But I am encouraged. Because after 4 years of difficult times in gold, we've just seen what gold can do. The first 2 months of the year, we've seen what gold can do. We don't know that it's going to continue, but we know that it can. And from my perspective, it is inevitable that we are still going to see some spectacular rises in gold. It could fall dramatically. It could yet fall dramatically, but it doesn't bother me on one level. You know, I would rather gold went up, and then it went up some more, and then it went up some more. But I'm not discouraged in the least bit. Gold has shown us in the first 2 months of the year what it's capable of doing, and I have no doubt that it's going to do it again and do it longer. Now, we'll see what happens. But in any case, if you had 100 ounces of gold and gold kept on rising at the current rate, by the end of the year, you'd be ahead $70,000 on 100 ounces of gold. That's pretty remarkable. Where am I? Let's go into, see what we've got here in the, here's an article I touched on during the day-to-day at the earlier program. There's a second financial crisis looming. That's headline from Real Money. And they compared 2008 to today. And this is part of the reason why I remain absolutely bullish on gold. Gold is not a fluke, whether it goes up, whether it goes down. I don't care right now. Long-term trend has to be up, up, and spectacularly up. Is this going to happen immediately? Is it going to happen this year? Don't know. But the problems we are facing, despite we get some good news from time to time. We see things that are, we get reports that, can lead us to take confidence in the economy. But overall, what we see for an economy is cause for pessimism, certainly for concern. For example, today the U.S. government debt, the official debt, totals about $19 trillion. All right? According to some sources, John Williams, Jadostats.com, he says it's actually closer to $100 trillion. Economist Lawrence Kotlikoff and the Congressional Budget Office have said that including unfunded liabilities, it's over $200 trillion. That's 10 times what they are officially reporting. I don't know who's telling the truth, but it's extremely unlikely that we're only, the U.S. national debt, it's extremely likely that it's only $19 trillion. But it is that much, for sure, which means it's $11 trillion more than it was in 2008. Now, that's money that's been injected into this economy or perhaps other economies in the world in order to try to avoid having a complete breakdown, a full-fledged economic depression. You have to ask yourself, the debt is $11 trillion more. It has more than doubled, according to these numbers. And again, this is from Real Money. More than doubled since 2008. There's no way you can look at that and say, oh, this is cause for, oh, we're, this thing's all under control. We got it. We got this. Don't worry about it. You know, it can't be. The debt is enormous. And sooner or later, it's going to bite us in the backside. The Fed's balance sheet is approaching $5 trillion versus $800 billion in 2008. Fed's balance sheet has gone deeper, six times deeper in debt than it was in 2008. That's a powerful and important number because from my perspective, it indicates that the Federal Reserve is no longer capable of stimulating the economy the way it did from 2008 on up until a year and a half ago when they closed down quantitative easing. I don't think they closed quantitative easing because the economy was strong and it was on track. I think they closed it because the Fed had dug a hole that was so deep that the Fed was concerned whether it would ever get out of it again. It is too much in debt, right? It has too much debt in its balance sheet to safely engage in more quantitative easing, in my opinion. Right? It may be that they're going to try some more, but I don't think they can. And if they can't, that means that if we have another significant financial event of the sort that we saw when Lehman Brothers collapsed and so on, and subprime mortgage rates all of a sudden created big problems back in 2007-2008, we're going to see another economic debacle, and there's going to be nobody to there will be no one to rescue us. Here's another item. Short-term interest rates are 0.25% compared to 4.5% back in 2008. That translates into about 1/18th of the interest rates are about 1/18th of what they were 8 years ago. How do banks make money at that rate? With the interest rates reduced so much, banks have to be under enormous stress, and they are. They're not going to be. They are vulnerable simply because they don't have enough capital to hold themselves together in the event of a serious problem. With interest rates at near record lows, there's little opportunity for the Fed to further expand its balance sheet. This is, again, that's a statement from Real Money, and it's consistent with an opinion I've had for at least a month, maybe 2 months, I don't recall clearly. But again, I don't think the Fed can step in to save us. And here's Real Money says, with interest rates at near record lows, there's little opportunity for the Fed to further expand its balance sheet. Expanding its balance sheet ultimately means creating more money in order to give to the government for the government to disperse into the economy and allegedly stimulate us out of a collapse. Fed can't help us. The derivatives market is currently larger than $500 trillion versus $180 trillion in 2008. Again, this is not part of the national debt. National debt is allegedly $19 trillion. The derivative market is $500 trillion, and that's here in the United States. I think it's bigger than that around. I think the global is much larger. But the point is, you compare $500 trillion in domestic derivatives to $19 trillion federal debt, and you have to conclude, you know, there's a lot of debt out there. If anything happens where the debt has to be repaid, and whoever is backing these derivatives are, well, we'll need $500 trillion from you. Can we expect a check in the mail tomorrow? And the answer is no, probably not. Maybe this weekend, or maybe next month, or maybe next year, or maybe never. Nobody's got $500 trillion. And yet somebody is holding $500 trillion in debt instruments, also known as derivatives. That goes south. I don't think anyone can imagine what kind of chaos might follow. Nobody knows what's going to happen. This is equivalent to me signing an IOU for $500 quadrillion. And the world sits back and says, oh, we've got a note here signed by Al for $500 quadrillion. And they go ahead and lend on it and borrow with it, and they go through all sorts of financial shenanigans without bothering to recognize there's no way in this life that I will ever be able to make good on a $500 quadrillion debt. And yet the world economies march forward as if some of these debt instruments, well, sure, they can pay that. No, they won't. They're not going to pay the national debt. If push comes to shove and someone has to make a call on these derivatives, they're not going to pay that either, at least not in full or even substantially. All of this, you know, it's just more evidence that we are facing some significant trouble. The size of the subprime mortgage bubble was $1.3 trillion back in 2008, but the size of sovereign borrowing is $7 trillion today. This is a really interesting point to me, because they are comparing, real money is implicitly comparing the government debt, government borrowing of $7 trillion today, they are comparing this to subprime mortgage borrowing back in 2006, 7, and on to 2008. And by implication, they're saying the government of the United States and others are subprime borrowers. Now, they didn't come right out and say that, but that's the implication of their comparison. And I think that implication is correct. You know, near zero interest rates that we have right now, well, I'm not even going to get into that. Well, the point is that our government is so deeply in debt that it will never be able to repay the existing debt. They're not going to be able to pay all of the $19 trillion they admit to owing. And they certainly won't pay the $100 trillion that John Williams thinks they owe, or the $200 trillion that the Congressional Budget Office and economist Lawrence Kotlikoff have claimed they owe. It's not going to be paid. All right? That is the same sort of insolvency that we saw in the subprime borrowers back in the years in 2005, 6, 7, 8. Huh? They can't pay the bill. The consequences, very nearly, of the subprime mortgage problem in 2007, it very nearly toppled the whole world economy. It's not unreasonable to suppose that the subprime borrowing problem we see among sovereigns today, $7 trillion, is six times the size of the problem we had with subprime mortgages back 8 years ago, 9 years ago. You can't look at that and sit back and say, well, the world is, the economy is strong, everything, we are in or near a recovery and everything's going to be happy. I don't think that's the way it's going to work out. We see too many problems. Yeah, we see the silver lining once in a while. There's one around here. We can see them and point them out, one thing or another. But where we are is caught in circumstances that are so enormous that it seems almost inevitable that we're going to see some sort of a global and or national monetary collapse, economic collapse. And when we do, the big problem will be that all of these debt instruments, which are nothing but promises to pay, that's what a debt instrument is, a promise to pay the $1,000 next week, next month, next year, most of them can't be paid. Most of the promises will be broken. And those of you that are waiting on those promises to be filled or fulfilled with your pension funds and bank accounts and stocks and bonds and whatever, you're going to find yourself losing most of your wealth, most of the wealth of you tied up in paper, in my opinion. And the way out of that is you get yourself some gold, you get yourself some silver. All right, among other things, get something tangible. Guns, land, bullets, food, water, something tangible. Tools, all right, gold and silver. We're going to take a break for some commercials. I'll be back in about 2.5 minutes with James Corbett, scheduled to be our guest from the Corbett Report. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. My guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from the Corbett Report. James is here, as usual, regular guest, to give us some insight into global economics, global politics. And James is, he's in Japan. He lives in Japan, and always interesting information and so on. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing over there?
Can't complain. Living the dream, you understand. What do you know about the concept of buyback blackout? Is that something you're familiar with?
It's not ringing a bell to me. Can you
let me give you a little description and see what you have to say about it. This is from an article in Bloomberg that just came out in the last day or two. And the headline is, buyback blackout leaves U.S. stocks on own prior to earnings. All right? Nobody could figure anything. That's like code. But here's some of the text. It says, last week, U.S. stocks entered part of the year when one of their biggest support systems is turned off. That support had been provided by U.S. corporations buying back their own stocks in order to enhance their earnings per share numbers. They're coming up to a quarterly report in 5 weeks, and they have been trying to, by purchasing their own stock, there's less stock out there. You divide the earnings by a reduced stock number of shares, and it shows up that you're making more per share than was the case when the investors were there. Buybacks, which reached a monthly record in February, have surged so much they make up about 2% of the daily volume, at least up until the buyback blackout. They are customarily suspended during the 5 weeks before companies report quarterly results. Some believe that without the corporations able to buy back their own stocks, the prices of those stocks will fall. The market indices will fall. And therefore, the next 5 weeks of the buyback blackout could trigger a significant decline in stock prices. Does that strike you as significant, improbable, much ado about nothing? What do you think?
Well, actually, yes. Okay. So now that I'm just looking this up, there is something to this because there's a chart up on MarketWatch.com showing the S&P 500 buyback index, looking specifically mm-hmm. at stocks that have been repurchased by companies, to be doing 5% better than the SPX itself, the S&P 500 index itself, since the February lows. So, in fact, the surge that we've seen since that February low has been apparently driven by these buybacks. So, and that is significant because, again, what does it ultimately indicate about the performance of the stock market that we're told is the bellwether of the economy? Although your listeners probably know by now that's not true. It shows that even that is built on a lot of, you know, goodwill, hope and change philium that the markets have been used to for the last 8 or 9 years now, because it is. If the company's plowing their own revenue streams back into buying their own shares to artificially inflate earnings. And one has to wonder if it's their corporate bond revenue streams that they're diverting to that, because, of course, it's been, you know, heyday for corporations issuing bonds in recent years as people have been flocking out of treasuries and into bonds to look for anything with a return. So corporations have been able to basically create their own mint with bonds lately. I wonder if they're just plowing that back into buying their own shares and making it look like a virtuous circle.
Well, they're up to something. You look at it, and it's just one more leaf in the breeze that tells us that the system is fragile, contrived. There's also implications in this. According to one report from Phoenix Capital Research, they're saying the main buyer, they're alleging that the main buyer has been the corporations themselves. The main buyer of stocks has been the major corporations themselves. And they're saying they're stepping out of the picture for the next 5 weeks, and they're anticipating that there could be some adverse consequences. And they're not talking about just 5%. It may be accurate that the price is 5% higher, but they're implying that the volume is over half the sales are at least half of them have been.
Right. The 5% was the S&P 500 buyback index outperforming the S&P 500 index by 5%. But that's, it could be 50% by volume.
Yeah, I know. So it's one of those things. It's, you know, what a complex web we weave when first we practice to deceive. The corporations have woven a pretty complex web here, but now they're at this buyback blackout, and you have to wonder, are we going to get through it without any problem? Or are we going to see a significant problem? Do you have an opinion?
Time will tell, but it certainly looks like a pretty tenuous situation for a lot of companies that are in this predicament. Monsanto has just entered their blackout a few weeks ago, and so far their year-to-date performance is down 7%. They're going to report their earnings on April 6th. United Rentals, Ameriprise, Express Scripts Holdings, AIG, Moody's, 21st Century Fox are all in or about to enter their blackout period, and All of them, except for Fox, is down on the year. So that's it may already be having an effect.
Mm-hmm. And we'll watch and see. There's a month left to see, without corporate support. If it's 7% down already, what will it be after a week? If it's down 7%, what will it be after 5 weeks? We'll watch and see, and it might be fine. I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen here, but... I don't know, another one of those leaves in the breeze. Here's another leaf coming out of Europe. This is Michael Snyder. And he says, the collapse of Italy's banks threatens to plunge the European financial system into chaos. Now, this is about 2 weeks ago he wrote this report. But he says, as Italy's banks begin to go down like dominoes, it's going to set off financial panic all over Europe, unlike anything we've seen before. Italian banking systems have declined by a whopping 28%. The problem in Italy appears to be significantly accelerating. What makes Italy so important? It's the eighth largest economy in the world. Italian banks are absolutely drowning in non-performing loans. And as Jeffrey Moore has noted, this potentially represents the greatest threat to the world's already burdened financial system. Is Italy that big, or is this more hype?
Maybe neither. Italy isn't that big on the big scheme of things, but it, you know, they talk about dominoes effects and things, but I think it's just actually more of a symptom of something that's happening largely in the European banking sector, that may be coming to a head in Italy right now, but I think it's happening elsewhere. And there's a report up on wolfstreet.com, Italy's banking crisis spirals elegantly out of control, that notes that, the Eurozone's third largest economy, Italy, is in full-blown banking crisis. Four small banks were rescued late last year, and the big ones are teetering. Their stocks have already crashed.
Yep.
So the numbers officially tossed around 201 billion euro, and other numbers estimate as many as 300 billion euro, or 18% of total outstanding loans, are in trouble. And that's a huge problem for Italy, but obviously for the Eurozone generally. And again, we've seen this playing out in the European stock indexes, specifically in the financial stock indexes, in the last few months, with the banking stocks bringing down the euro stocks generally. And I think, again, this is just a symptom of a larger problem. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know about domino theories or what have you, but I think at any rate, as a symptom of what's happening in the eurozone, it's definitely up there in terms of importance.
What about domino theories? I mean, we've been listening to domino theories, and I've advocated them to some degree. I've certainly believed them. I still do. But the dominoes have been remarkably stable over the past several years. A lot of us have looked at this and thought this whole thing should have blown up years ago. And yet something seems to be holding the dominoes upright. Are the dominoes refusing to fall just by dumb luck? Or are there people in control that are able to hold the dominoes up?
I think the real answer is that there are millions of possible paths for these dominoes to fall through. And so people can speculate on this path or that path and keep their eyes on those indicators, whereas the real action may be happening elsewhere. And I think we see this every time there is an actual bubble pop or an actual collapse, like with the Lehman collapse. When you look at that in hindsight, you recognize the dominoes that were falling in front of it. You notice them, the Bear Stearns and all of those warnings and flashing indicators that had been going on for years in the housing market that ultimately led to Lehman. But you don't necessarily see that while it's happening. And if you do, well, you might stand to profit from it in a big way, like those people in The Big Short, the movie that just came out talking about the investors who saw those dominoes collapsing. I think in this case as well, I mean, there's no doubt that the Eurozone is in serious deep trouble. But the question for traders and people who have that in mind is, okay, well, which way is it going to fall? What's going to fall first, and where is it going to fall first? Because if you have that kind of insight, of course, there's always a way to profit from it, even in the wake of collapse or in the midst of collapse. As collapse is going, it's actually more profitable if you can see which way. As I say, there's millions of different ways that the dominoes could fall, though. Could it start in Italy banking sector and spread out from there? Could it be related to Greece and the shenanigans going on there? Could it be something, a kind of black swan event? And if you can predict that, there's lots of money to be made if that's your end goal.
What's more important? I mean, what we're talking about here is that the dominoes when they do start clicking, they're pretty much invisible up until the time when they start to fall. We have confidence in the system, and we sit back and say, oh, the domino theory, that's not going to work. That don't have to worry about that. We've got everything under control. The dominoes are kind of invisible to us until something like Lehman Brothers happens, and then all of a sudden we say, oh, my gosh. Well, so long as we don't believe in dominoes, are the dominoes real? I mean, if a domino falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it make a sound? You get what I'm getting here? This has a lot to do with public confidence, whether we perceive the dominoes or not. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, it really does have a lot to do with that in the exact same way as the housing bubble. I mean, can you imagine if people were listening to people like Peter Schiff back in 2005, 2006, who were saying, this is a bubble, it's going to pop, the prices don't deserve to be where they are. Instead of laughing at them, if people had paid attention to him and taken a look at the analysis and agreed with it, then the bubble wouldn't have inflated as much as it did over the next couple of years when people still continued to pile on. In the same way, I mean, there are people talking about, you know, the collapse of the Eurozone and the European banking sector who are being laughed at. And if, you know, a year or two from now, they turn out to be right, there will be millions, hundreds of tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people who wished they would have been listening to those calls beforehand. So it's always a question of perspective and what people understand about what's happening. And I don't think the dominoes are necessarily invisible if you're looking at them and looking at them for what they are, in the same way the housing bubble was perfectly visible to anyone who really wanted to look at it. But there were a lot of people whose very livelihoods and the fortunes that they were making depended on them not recognizing that. And as they say, you know, you can't make someone recognize something that their livelihood depends on them not recognizing.
When we talk about recognizing the dominoes, is this a function of perception and intelligence, or is it primarily a function of courage? Does it take intelligence to see the dominoes, or does it take courage to say, I see that thing's going to fall over? Which is more important, the courage? Because a lot of people, from my perspective, it's not that they don't see things. They see the evidence, and yet they don't have the courage to accept the evidence. They just say, no, that can't be. You follow what I'm saying?
I do. I think fundamentally what drives most people, maybe not people who are in this game, have skin in the game, traders and those types of people who are intimately involved in it, but most people are just, in this case, kind of driven by their own sense of their perception of their own risk in the game. Is this going to affect me? If so, how? When? And if they don't see an imminent threat to themselves, then they're probably not going to pay a lot of attention to it. And
so they're not looking over the horizon.
Exactly. I don't know if you can necessarily fault people for that, because there are a million things you could be paying attention to right now. Why pay attention to this rather than that? It is a difficult thing, and most people just want to come home after a long day of work and crack open a beer and watch a football game. I understand that mentality, and I'm not necessarily putting those people down, because why should it be incumbent on them to worry about what's happening in the European banking sector or all these types of things? It wouldn't matter if our lives weren't as completely centralized and becoming more centralized as they are now, with more and more power, financial power and political power, being centralized in places like Brussels, which has nothing to do with the lives of the average person, you know, living their life in Rome or Florence or wherever else. But for some reason, they're politically wedded, because the people behind the scenes have been creating this web for them to catch them in.
What do you make of the bombing in Brussels? Do you think it has political implications relative to the New World Order, or is Brussels just happened to be convenient for the terrorists?
Well, it will have political implications. I mean, I we're going to start seeing in the coming weeks, we're going to see the next stage of the rollout of the next crackdown on security at airports. I mean, that's going to roll out over the Western world, and there's going to be new procedures going in, and who knows what kind of, you know, new mandatory screenings and tests and scanners and all of that stuff. So that will be rolling out as a direct consequence of this. And I think there will be, assuming this will be blamed as it seems like it's going to be on the Islamic State, there will be some sort of ramifications in terms of Syria and what's going on there, and perhaps the ending of the peace talks, which I think is interesting because of some interesting warnings that Erdogan made a few days ago that maybe we can talk about after the break.
All right. We will talk. Oh, yeah. He reported that he warned them that at least one of these guys that were letting into Brussels was a terrorist, was known to be a terrorist. We'll talk about that in a moment when we return to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addis here with my guest, James Corbett. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Please stay tuned.
Condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Go ahead and visit for some insights into global economics, global politics. James, you wanted to talk something. You wanted to say something about Turkish President Erdogan's warnings relative to the recent terrorism attack. Is that right?
That's right. And you mentioned that the fact that one of the bombers was deported from Turkey. But just 4 days before the attack, Erdogan had specifically said at a commemoration ceremony for the 101st anniversary of the Battle of Gallipoli, he said specifically, there is no reason why the bomb that exploded in Ankara, referring to the recent bombing in Turkey, cannot explode in Brussels, in any other European city. The snakes you are sleeping with can bite you any time, talking about the idea of, he was really referring to Kurdish militants and those dastardly terrorists. But I think the warning seems particularly apt that 4 days later, of course, it was Brussels specifically that was hit. And as you say, it was Ibrahim al-Bakrawi, who has been identified as one of these bombers, who was specifically deported from Turkey in 2015 with a warning from Turkey to Belgian authorities that, you know, this guy's dangerous and he might attack. So this guy was known about beforehand. And it's interesting that this comes just days after Erdogan's warning, because this factors, I think, deeply into Turkey's role in what's happening in Syria, because Turkey, of course, has been intimately involved in helping fostering the terrorist insurgency in Syria since the beginning for a number of reasons, destabilizing Assad's government and gaining regional power. But it has awakened and incited the Kurdish militants within Turkey. And now that's the idea of a Kurdish homeland being carved out of Syria as part of the peace talks has, I think, put the fear of God into Erdogan and Turkey that this peace process might not be going in a good way for Turkey. So what's the best thing that could happen for Turkey? More military intervention in Syria, more renewed cries. We got to get more boots on the ground. We got to get more, you know, chaos going. We can't allow these militants to get any ground, including, oh, by the way, the Kurds. So it works out very well for Turkey, potentially, depending, you know, how the narrative plays out in the next few days.
When you say it works out very well for Turkey, do you mean by it, do you mean the bombings in Brussels? And are you implying that Turkey may have played a role in causing those bombings?
I leave it as a possibility on the table. I think all the possibilities are there right now, and I don't know if it necessarily means that Turkey was puppeting these people to do this. But certainly, I mean, the warning is particularly prescient, and the fact that the reaction could very well directly benefit Turkey, which is, as I say, deathly afraid of this idea of a Kurdish homeland being carved out right on the border, which would obviously incite the Kurdish factions within Turkey itself to further agitate for their own homeland and carving out part of Turkey's territory, which has been, I mean, that's one of the major fights that Turkey's engaged in right now. And one of the things that they're engaged in Syria is not attacking Islamic State or anyone else, but attacking the Kurds. So, again, depending how this reaction plays out, and we know that Turkish officials have been caught on tape. I've played the tapes on my podcast before, actually plotting to do a false flag event in Syria to try to involve NATO in Syria, to try to kick in the article, was it Article 4 or Article 5, the collective self-defense clause of NATO, which would necessitate NATO stepping in to save Turkey from this attack from Syria. We know they've been caught on tape plotting to stage such an attack before, so it's not out of the realm of possibility that what happened in Brussels could be being directed from Ankara.
Did Turkey's president go to the same grade school and college as the premier of North Korea?
Probably.
It seems like they're both eager to cause trouble given the opportunity. They like to stir the pot, it seems like. I don't know if that's a if I'm misunderstanding, but it does look like they're very similar. Of course I don't seriously believe they went to the same schools, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
Here's one of the things that crosses my mind. Is a police
state. Turkey has been really important in the war on terror in ways that people probably don't realize, and it's been a haven and a hub for the fostering of terror across state lines in Central Asia, in the Middle East, and perhaps potentially in Europe. And I think people should start looking into that history.
I'm wondering if a police state is inevitable in a complex, advanced society. And the reason I wonder that is because it seems to me that a complex economy is far more vulnerable than a simple economy, a less advanced economy. And what I mean by that metaphor, you take your sundial, it can be made out of a slab of concrete with something like a triangle located at one point. You set it up where it points due north, part of it points due north, and you make a few marks on it. And it'll keep time for you for centuries. You can leave it out in the sun and the rain and the wind and the snow and the ice and the rest of that sort of thing. And if it falls over, you just set it back up and line it up correctly, and it'll keep time. Now, it doesn't keep it very accurately. It's not very efficient, and it doesn't work at all during the night, but it works. No batteries, no moving parts, simple. You take a Swiss chronometer that'll keep exquisitely perfect time. And it's got wheels and gears and springs and the rest of that sort of thing. If you give that Swiss chronometer a little rap with a little hammer, you can finish it off its efficiency, it is so efficient that it becomes increasingly vulnerable. All right? And to me, a complex advanced economy is much the same because we have power lines that cross continent, and they can't be defended every step of the way, every foot, every lineal foot. We have all sorts of infrastructure that has critical vulnerabilities, and it opens the door for just a handful of people to come in and focus an attack on a particular small, vulnerable spot that can't be defended just because you can't defend it all. And all of a sudden, they can shut down a big chunk of that economy, at least temporarily, and maybe, you know, maybe for a considerable period of time. What I'm getting to is this. If my analogy is correct, if the comparison between the simple economy and the complex economy corresponds to the I can't even think now, I'm losing my marbles here, the sundial and the Swiss chronometer. If that corresponds, do we have a choice other than to accept a police state that will try to watch everybody in order to keep just a handful of crazy people out?
Right. I get it, what you're saying, and it certainly does pertain to the physical infrastructure that we have these days. And I think the obvious example would be pipeline infrastructure, extremely important energy infrastructure that is being laid and has been laid and is extremely vulnerable to sabotage because, as you say, miles and miles, hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles that cannot be defended at every single square inch. So absolutely, that type of physical infrastructure exists, and multiply that by all of the electronic cyber infrastructure that now exists that is equally, I think, vulnerable to all sorts of attacks and hasn't really played into these types of situations too much yet. But I guarantee you in the coming years, the idea of cyber terrorism is going to be more and more played on. And so the question is, does this mean that there is just going to be a police state because you can't police at all, so you better police everyone. And now we have the surveillance technologies that could potentially do that. I think there is a logic to that, and that is the logic that is being played out right now. And we're going to see that, for example, as I say, in the wake of this Brussels bombing, we're going to see the new procedures and scanners and all of that being rolled out at airports worldwide. So every time there's an event, there's a reaction to the event. Is it necessarily the response? And I would say no, because it is a matter of perception. It is a matter of perspective. Facing down, for whatever the Soviet Cold War threat was really about, facing down this, nuclear-armed nation that could have completely obliterated the United States and wiped it off the face of the map in a matter of minutes or hours, versus, this amorphous terror threat of people with bombs that might kill 30 people at a time, tragic as it is not the existential threat that was faced before without the need for that kind of police state. In fact, at that time, the rhetoric, at any rate, was all about freedom and we live free and this is our victory over those damn Ruskies. But now the terrorists, stage a few bombings and people are already willing and to throw away their remaining liberties. So I don't think it's necessarily the answer, but it is the logic of all state bureaucracies. That's the way they are set up to operate. That is the way they will respond to these attacks. And unless a big giant wrench is thrown into those works to stop them from going, we know where this script leads.
You mentioned the impact on air travel. They're going to have more rigorous security checks. Is that going to slow? Is it going to dissuade a lot of people or a significant number of people from engaging in air travel? Say, I'm tired. I don't want to be groped anymore. I don't want to be x-rayed anymore. I'll take a train or I'll stay at home. Will the airlines suffer a revenue loss because of the new and improved security systems?
Yes, in the short term. In the long term, perhaps the plan is to further implement those types of things that we've seen coming online in recent years, where you can be pre-approved and pre-screened, and you can breeze through the lineups because you're a VIP, because you've been pre-approved by the proper channels, and you have whatever chip or card or whatever. I think that's going to be the push eventually, because this will obviously dissuade, you know, people just from going on holiday trips and that type of thing. They don't want to put up with it. And so the airlines and a lot of people, the tourist industries are going to be calling out for, well, we need some sort of solution. What's the solution? Well, as long as you're pre-approved, as long as you, you know, give up these details to the government about your travel plans, then you can be pre-approved. So that's coming. And I'm already seeing that, in fact, in Japan. There's new procedures coming in that I didn't even know about until I recently had to renew my Canadian passport. And they're telling me that now my son, born in Japan, Japanese citizen, but also can be a Canadian dual citizen until he's 18, can't travel into Canada without a Canadian passport now, because he isn't eligible for this special program they're doing for foreigners and blah, blah, blah. There's new procedures going in all the time that's making it harder and harder for people to even just travel with their families. So it's getting to be kind of crazy out there, and I'm sure it's only going to increase from here.
I understand. We live in interesting times. Here's Alan Greenspan. He was interviewed on Bloomberg TV and radio, and during the course of the interview, he was asked about the state of the U.S. global economy and global economies, and he said, we're in trouble basically because productivity is dead in the water. And he went on to say he hasn't been optimistic for quite a while. He won't be optimistic until, he says, I won't be optimistic until we can resolve the entitlement programs. Nobody wants to touch it, and that is gradually crowding out capital investment, and that's crowding out productivity, and it's crowding out standards of living. Where do you want me to go from there? Alan Greenspan is saying that the entitlement program in this country is too large to allow us to once again become productive. Do you agree with that? Do you see this as a significant – is this a significant step in the way people view entitlements? Do they have to be shut down or diminished, or can they be continued?
Well, I mean, mathematically they do at some point, because there is not and will not be enough money to pay for them. There are unfunded liabilities to the tunes of however many trillions, depending on which way you add it up, that the U.S. government does not have. So, yes, there are. I mean, it's unsustainable in that sense. And Obamacare and other things that are coming on that are just making it harder and harder for employers to employ employees certainly do contribute to that and take away from capital spending and all of that that Greenspan was talking about. He's not wrong in that analysis. I mean, there are other things that we could note here, like, for example, the $1 trillion when you add up the defense budget and the intelligence budget. I'm sure there is some way that could be tinkered with before we have to start cutting people's entitlements, or at least the things that they've been promised. But yeah, at some point someone's gonna have to bite the bullet and do something about it. And the last politician that I heard with an actual plan about that was Ron Paul, talking about making it an opt-out possibility for young people. But that's politically unviable. That's crazy talk. Who would ever think of that?
Speaking of Ron Paul, here we've got, what, maybe 45 seconds left. Ron Paul was recently quoted as saying, Russia leaves Syria. When do we? Is the United States going to leave Syria anytime soon? Should we? Can we? And you got 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, it would have been easier if they'd never been there in the first place. It's one of those things. Can you just leave? And I guess, yes, you can. What kind of mess is that going to leave behind? Well, should have thought of that before you started supporting all the terrorists in Libya that they also supported in Syria. So, yeah, it's a huge mess. There's no easy answer. And yes, I mean, the U.S. should get out militarily and in terms of their support to the terrorists, because they're only making it worse.
Should have done the same thing in relation to Vietnam much earlier than we finally had our peace with honor, but maybe that's a lesson here. We have to let it go at that. James, thank you for being on the program. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Payments fast, and still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. Ah! Money, always funny.